The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you interested in the cutting edge of investing? That means frontier and emerging markets. And would you like to get started? Or perhaps you are already investing but still have questions? Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. On today's program, we'll take a look at news, trends, and background information that you should know to become an informed investor in new and emerging opportunities. Now, here is your host, Gavin Graham.
Hello, I'm Gavin Graham, and I'm here with Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing each Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific, and 2 p.m. in the UK. Each week, with my global roster of guests, I'll be talking about emerging and frontier market investing and trying to clear up some of the misconceptions about these markets, which we feel are amongst the most attractive investment opportunities at present. I spent most of my professional life analyzing investments and hiring fund managers to handle large amounts of investors' money. And I figure that I can spot the differences between promising investments and those which are not so promising. By emerging markets, of course, we mean the BRIC countries. That's Brazil, Russia, India, and China. But it also includes major emerging markets such as Turkey, Chile, Mexico, and the Czech Republic. Today, we'll be having a look at why some multinationals that may be in your portfolio prefer Mexico to Brazil, despite the fact that Brazil is hosting the Soccer World Cup next year and the Summer Olympics in 2016. By frontier markets, we mean countries like Colombia, Vietnam, Nigeria, Kenya, Bangladesh, Kazakhstan, Ghana, Slovenia, Slovakia, and Botswana. Today, we'll be having a look at Vietnam, which heads some list of the most promising frontier markets. We'll also be looking at some of the Eastern European countries, and in fact, that's where I'm going to start today. I have John Derrick on the line from U.S. Global Advisors, who's been a regular guest on this show talking about the European markets. Some of our listeners may remember John's analysis of the optimistic prospects for Greece several weeks ago. That led to a few raised eyebrows amongst our audience. But today we're going to ask John to have a look at some of the other European markets for 2014, some of which analysis might also be a little bit of a surprise to conventional wisdom. Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, John.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. Now, during the last segment you did with us, you had a very positive outlook on Greece. Could you very briefly recap that and whether it's changed or not since we last spoke?
Sure. Nothing's really changed as far as Greece. It's a multi-year recovery story, and so really I think it's an opportunity. One recently moved into the MSCI Emerging Market Index, and so you saw some activity surrounding that right near the end of October, near the end of November, but things have kind of calmed down. But it's somewhat tied to the European recovery. But Greece has gone through 6 years of recession. They're finally starting to come out on the other side of it. Looks like maybe next year. And it's just a classic, you know, story. The pain, there's been so much pain induced that you finally start that recovery cycle. And it's very simple in a lot of ways. And so I think that's the simple story. It's an economic recovery story after 6 years of a recession, and you're finally starting to come out the other end of it. And we think the banks are probably the most interesting way to play that. That's kind of how our quick and dirty assessment of it.
John, that's what was formerly a developed market that's now, thanks to the recession, been downgraded to emerging market status. On the other side of the coin, you have the formerly communist East European countries, some of which have made great strides in shaking off their communist history. Some have not. Is that because some of the economies were healthier or that their governments were taking a more reformist attitude?
Yeah, I think it, particular in emerging markets and frontier markets, I think government policy is key in a lot of these markets. And I think the reformist type of policies, the pro-capital market policy, pro-free trade, and all those kind of things, I think are probably the most significant driver of the differences there. And there obviously are cultural differences between countries and those kind of things. But good government policy is, if you don't have good policies, it's difficult to overcome. And I think that's really been the difference maker, you know, places like Poland and those things that have good policies. You've seen, you know, positive results out of that. So I think, you know, and then, you know, right before we came on the air, we were talking about Ukraine, and Ukraine is an example of maybe poor government policies or poor, you know, internal politics that drive, you know, bad policies that scare investors away. And so I think, you know, another one, you know, not in Europe, but, you know, Venezuela, kind of poor government policy, Argentina, poor government policy, et cetera. So it's hard to overcome if you have those poor policies.
No, absolutely, and that was very much the conclusion from the book we wrote, Investing in Frontier Markets, that government policy, as it were, almost the cultural approach that certain countries take towards reform and investment is the major determinant. Would it be fair to say that those countries with the closest ties to the rest of Europe have fared better?
I would say that's generally true. I think because there's a cultural, a closer cultural affinity and probably a closer cultural, acceptance of free market policies and more capitalistic policies and those types of things. So I would say that's generally true, yeah.
So where do all of these changes leave Russia, which obviously as one of the BRIC countries, and as the former ruler of most of these countries for half a century after World War II, has found adjusting to its different situation something of a challenge, I think it's fair to say, in the last 20-odd years.
Yeah, no, definitely. Russia's a little bit of a challenge right now. Actually, I think within that kind of emerging Europe space that we look at, you know, GDP estimates are coming down, whereas in other places they're going up. And I think right now, because of you know, kind of the political situation there and government policy. Government policy still have not been, you know, actually I think Russia's taken a step back. I think if you go back 10 or 12 years ago, they were doing the right things and moving in the right directions because they had to, because commodity prices were so low and et cetera. And so now, you know, commodity prices have been strong for so long that they feel emboldened to do other things. And so from a corporate governance standpoint, from a lot of the kind of state-owned or state-backed companies, we've seen some poor allocation decision, capital allocation decisions, at least as far as minority equity investors are concerned. And so I think Russia right now needs higher commodity prices to really kind of get going again and get kick-started again. I mean, a global economic, kind of synchronized global economic recovery, we've talked about actually several times on this show, I think will help. But Russia is definitely in a little bit different situation than some of the other countries in the region. And it seems to be struggling right now, and like I said, I think it almost needs just higher commodity prices to really get that economy kickstarted again.
Yes, that commodity price issue, I suppose, has been one of the things that's led to somewhat disappointing performance for most of the emerging markets over the last year, and it's been a theme with several of our guests pointing out. While developed markets have been galloping ahead 20-30%, the emerging market index is actually down for the year, and some markets are actually down quite substantially. Is that entirely down to lower commodity prices due to Chinese growth not being as high as expected, or are there some country-specific aspects as well driving that?
Yeah, I think China, you know, if you go back a year ago, there was a lot of concerns about China and what China would do. And as we've discussed before on the show, China actually, I think, positively surprised relative to where expectations were a year or so ago.
Yep.
And I think Europe is kind of positively surprised from where we were a year ago and those kind of things. And so it's interesting to me that in emerging markets have underperformed this year, basically like you said, flat to down. And actually, Merrill Lynch, Bank of America Merrill Lynch, they do a monthly survey. And one of the things that I thought was very interesting last month, it came out in November, was the pessimism among global fund managers was still very stubbornly bearish on emerging market investors. And what was interesting is the bearishness was equivalent to where we were in 2001 and 2002, even worse than during the financial crisis. And to me, that is a very interesting, you know, it seems like the pessimism has gone too far. And as, you know, Europe has performed well, U.S. markets have performed well, valuations are very cheap in these markets. Even in Eastern Europe in particular, if you go back since the crisis, Eastern Europe or kind of the Eastern European markets have even underperformed emerging markets over that period of time by a wide margin. And I think when you start looking in the region, you have places like, I know we talked about Russia, and Russia has a lot of issues, but Russia trades very, you know, quote, cheaply, you know, 5 to 6 mm-hmm. times earnings if you look at the index. Yep. And granted, there's reasons for that, but that's even historically, that's very cheap. But you start looking at Hungary and Poland and Czech Republic and Turkey and all, and a lot of countries in the region, they're all trading at what appear to be relatively cheap valuations relative to where they've traded in the last decade or so. And so after a year of flat earnings, kind of this stubbornly bearish assessment from global fund managers and all those kind of things, and you have catalysts on the horizon, such as continued European recovery and just kind of, I think this kind of synchronized global economic recovery, I think could be the catalyst. Investors are coming back into the equity market, and I think that will start to spread out. And I think people will realize that emerging markets are probably a pretty attractive place. And then when you look within emerging markets, you can see places like Eastern Europe as being particularly attractive. And I think it's an interesting play for 2014.
Absolutely. As you say, the valuations really do look pretty attractive now. Would there be any differentiation in your view between the major emerging markets, such as, say, Poland and Hungary and the Czech Republic, and maybe some of the less established frontier markets like Romania or Croatia, which have done somewhat better over the last year, partially because of inflows? Or would you just think that, quite frankly, you can buy the asset class as a whole and you'll do fairly well?
Yeah, I think you can buy the asset class as a whole. I think for most investors, it's going to be very difficult. I think Romania is an interesting story. Romania is probably has the best economic growth in the kind of EU area this year. I think it's something like 4%. And so Romania has actually done very well. But there's kind of limited number of investable securities in Romania. And so I think for, you know, the average investor, you know, buying something that just gives you exposure to the whole region is the way to go. Even in Romania, while we do have a couple of positions in Romania, I think a lot of how we play it is through, you know, like something like an Erste Bank, which is an Austrian bank, but has a pretty big operation in Romania. And so we try to, we even go indirectly to play some of these other countries like, Romania or Croatia or something like that. And I think for, the average investor that's probably listening to the show is, that's probably the way to go as well. And these markets can be pretty fickle sometimes. And so I think handing it off to a professional manager maybe is the way to go for most people anyway.
No, absolutely. And that was the conclusion from our book. Thanks very much indeed, John, for all of the input you've given us this year. Again, we hope we can speak to you in the new year as to what's happening, particularly in Eastern Europe.
Great. Thanks, Gavin.
Thanks. Our thanks to John Derrick, Portfolio Manager at U.S. Global Advisors in San Antonio, Texas, for that outlook at Eastern Europe and Russia for 2014. When I come back for the break, I'll have a look at why some multinational corporations that you might hold in your portfolio prefer Mexico to Brazil, in spite of Brazil's preparation for the Soccer World Cup next year and the Summer Olympics in 2016. Please stay with me for that. Thanks very much.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
This program is produced by EFMI Media, which has become the leader in information about emerging and frontier markets investing. EFMI recently compiled the book entitled Investing in Frontier Markets: Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, set for release by John Wiley & Sons later this year, and another book, also on frontier markets, which will be on store bookshelves later in the year. We are also launching a newsletter called EFMI. For more information, email info@emergingfrontier.ca. For more news about upcoming program segments, the books we have written, or the EFMI newsletter, please email info@emergingfrontier.ca. You can call 416-944-1750.
Are you feeling slammed and suckered in today's stock market? If so, then you need to tune in to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, Jordan Kimmel will train you in what you can do to beat up the big boys on Wall Street, as well as share his secrets to success so that you can buy and sell like a profit-pumping pro. Grab the bull market by the horns and listen to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. We frequently heard about the economic opportunities that could flow from the two major sporting events that Brazil is staging in the next couple of years, the Soccer World Cup next June and July, and its hosting of the Summer Olympics in 2016. However, my next guest says that some of the multinationals who are looking to increase their presence in Latin America have actually chosen Mexico over Brazil, especially given that Brazil is looking to increase its attractiveness. That's maybe a little surprising. But to talk about that, I have Nancy Hubbard on the line from Goucher College in Maryland. She's a professor of management there, an author of Conquering Global Markets, Secrets from the World's Most Successful Multinationals. Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, Nancy.
Thank you, Graham. It's a pleasure to be here.
Not at all. So although the situation can change, and maybe we'll touch on that a little later in the interview, you're suggesting that some multinationals are looking to make inroads in Latin America via Mexico rather than Brazil.
Especially those from North America and Europe. Brazil has really been the darling of the emerging world from its BRIC relationships and name. And it's done very well with massive growth over the past few years. However, it seems to be a stage now where multinationals are actually looking more to Mexico for a variety of reasons over Brazil.
So what's holding them back from Brazil, given the anticipation that the two major sporting events, the World Cup and the Summer Olympics, will provide a boost to GDP, as has been the case for other emerging markets such as China and South Korea over the last couple of decades?
Well, there are a few reasons. The first one is, if you are actually servicing the Brazilian market, you have to be in Brazil. So those companies are still moving into Brazil for those reasons. However, a lot of the big infrastructure contracts that have been awarded for the Olympics and for the World Cup have gone to Brazilian companies. So foreign companies have really been not excluded, but primarily excluded in those contracts.
Yep.
In addition, the Brazilian government, I think in some ways, may have been taken aback by the foreign investment spree of 2010 and 2011. And they have started to implement or are considering implementing some measures that could exclude foreign investing companies from certain industries and from certain activities such as owning land. So I think there's a fair degree of uncertainty with foreign investors in entering Brazil at the moment. And on top of that, Brazil also has a history of being a highly bureaucratic within the different regions in Brazil. It's not a cheap place to do business, with energy costs being very high and management costs being very high, whereas Mexico is being seen as more attractive.
So there are a number of negatives or sort of drags on the performance of foreign investors in Brazil, which come from such things, as you said, as high costs, bureaucracy, some element of protectionism maybe. Nonetheless, as you say, there has been a lot of investment in there. Would there be any major industries that, despite all of these negatives, are actually likely to be major beneficiaries from the sporting events. I would presume things like tourism-related industries certainly would be a major area where foreign investors could expect to benefit.
Absolutely. Car rental, hotels, yep. Restaurants, all of those will benefit highly from the huge influx of tourism. Airlines as well. What they tend to do, though, is not invest more, just charge higher prices during those time periods.
Yes,
so
indeed.
It's not like the country is going to be getting a, you know, an influx of additional investment. They're just the companies that are already there will be charging more and making more for that.
Right, and obviously we're all familiar with that phenomenon, and it's only logical behavior on the part of the companies. But would it be fair to say that multinationals looking to expand within Latin America in general would have greater confidence in Mexico than Brazil at this time?
I believe so. There are a couple issues playing on that. One is Mexico's forecast to have a higher GDP growth and recovery next year when compared to Brazil. So I think that brings investors some comfort. Also, its proximity to the U.S. has always been a draw for low-cost manufacturing. So if you are, for instance, the car industry, we can just look at the car industry briefly and seeing what they're doing in Mexico. But if you look at their ability to manufacture, they're going to choose a Mexico over a Brazil because of a lower cost base for the actual workers.
Yep.
And the logistical and transportation costs of getting into the United States, and the fact that Mexico is part of the North American Free Trade Agreement makes a huge difference when it comes to exports and tariffs.
Absolutely. I mean, it's way easier to actually drive across the border if you're transporting goods, especially quite heavy and bulky goods like automobiles, rather than trying to fly them in from Brazil. Would you say also that export point is a major one? Because apart from raw materials, does Brazil have much in the way of manufactured exports, or is it primarily for the local market?
They are a massive exporter, especially of items such as automobiles. So, for instance, this year we've had Nissan, Honda, Mazda, and VW all invest over $6 billion in the past couple of years. In the past couple of years, they've invested about $6 billion to bolster up their car manufacturing operations in Mexico. And in addition, in the past few weeks, we've had BMW, Toyota, and Daimler all pledge $2 billion plus to, again, either increase their production or to build new facilities with the intention of manufacturing for the U.S. market.
So that's very much the export story for Mexico.
Yes.
But again, for Brazil, with one or two exceptions like, say, Embraer regional jets, most of Brazil's exports, if I'm correct in my memory, are largely raw materials. So if you're manufacturing in Brazil, it would be very much for the local Brazilian domestic market. Would that be correct?
Absolutely. Yes, it is. Yep. It's just too far away from the other major markets and too expensive relative to some of the cheaper markets that are nearby to do any form of export out of Brazil. So all the input, the investment has been for the local Brazilian market, which is a substantial and growing market. But
right.
The lure of Mexico is that you have the U.S. right next door and you have NAFTA.
Right, and also a substantial domestic market there too.
Absolutely.
So would you have some examples of multinationals that are expanding more? You've already mentioned, obviously, the major car companies, but are there other multinational industries or industries that are expanding more in Mexico than in Brazil, for example?
Yes, I mean, the car industry and all the infrastructure companies that support them are a big one. Another industry that is poised to move more into Mexico would be the oil and refining industry because while there is obviously a significant presence there already, there has been a move on the Mexican government to relax some of the restrictions on ownership. So we should expect a bigger move for foreign multinationals to be moving into Mexico in the oil industry and then again all the related refining support industries. Coca-Cola has invested recently. They're investing $5 billion in Mexico to bolster up their production there. Again, that is for the local market, that is not for important to the United States. And Odebrecht, ironically, the Brazilian company, is investing $8 billion in energy and highway in Mexico. But my guess is they've you know, taken care of their own domestic market and are now just looking to expand overseas.
Okay. So it would be fair to say that Mexico has certainly been a better performer than Brazil, that it's probably a more attractive market in multinationals' eyes because of that export potential due to its proximity to the States, as well as a large domestic market. Having said that, just before we came on air, we were discussing the fact that maybe Mexico is a little ahead of itself, especially given that Brazil's performance has been fairly poor this year. Would you agree that maybe, despite the issues we've talked about, people might want to look at Brazil a little more favorably?
Absolutely. Mexico's stock exchange has risen 50% this year, or 50% in the past 3 years. So it's it has dropped off a little off of its high of a few months ago. But the Brazilian stock exchange has actually really cooled and dropped quite considerably. So it does mean that there should be some opportunities for investors looking into Brazil. And the long-term perspective and potential it holds simply because of its size and because of its stage of economic development.
And obviously there will be a major focus on it with the World Cup less than 6 months away now. Just to finish up here, Nancy, from your analysis of the sort of infrastructure that's in place for multinationals to make it attractive to them, despite the challenges we've talked about, and as you mentioned, we've had a period of underperformance by Brazil, which has obviously made it look somewhat cheaper, Brazil still remains an attractive market longer term for multinational investors.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It is still the largest economy in the region. It's still larger than Mexico, and it's still it is a stage of economic development that it provides a wonderful opportunity for investment as the growing middle class develops. And as soon as the government, I know they're struggling with the uncertainty of some political unrest there, but as soon as that is sorted out and they get their tariffs sorted out between their regions, it will be even a more attractive place for investment.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much indeed, Nancy. That's a very interesting and insightful look into the relative attractions of the two giants in Latin America. And as mentioned at the beginning of this piece, maybe a little surprise to people, but Mexico certainly does appear to be the one where there's more interest from multinationals. So we hope we can have you back to discuss which other markets multinationals might be finding attractive in emerging and frontier markets sometime in the new year.
Thank you, Ram. It's always a pleasure.
And you. Thanks to Professor and author Nancy Hubbard on the line from Goucher College in Baltimore, Maryland. And again, I think it's a fair point to make in that the fact that a country is holding an Olympics or a World Cup, for that matter, as with South Africa in with the World Cup 4 years ago, does not necessarily mean that it's going to be a bonanza for foreign investors, and secondly, that the country itself is necessarily going to do particularly well simply because of the extra investment that's gone into that country because of the major sporting event. In some cases, it actually pulls forward investment that might have otherwise been taken place and makes it more expensive because you have to get it done by a certain time. When I come back from the break, we'll have a look at one of the Southeast Asian countries that ranks at or near the top of lists of the most promising frontier markets. Please stay with me for that.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This program comes to you from the EFMI Media Company. EFMI Media is one of the most comprehensive sources of information and analysis on emerging and frontier markets. EFMI Media has become a leader in knowledge, expertise, and analysis of emerging and frontier markets, both in opportunities to investigate and pitfalls to avoid. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca or call 416-944-1750. EFMI Media produces this program, researched and wrote Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is set for release later this year, and is currently working on a second book, also on frontier markets. EFMI also publishes a newsletter called EFMI Information and provides knowledgeable speakers on these and other topics. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca, or call 416-944-1750.
Hi, I'm Joe Swedish, CEO of WellPoint. We proudly support the March of Dimes and all they do to reduce the rate of premature birth in the United States. Though premature births have recently declined, still 500,000 babies are born too soon each year. We're helping the March of Dimes fund cutting-edge research and community programs that help moms and their babies live healthier lives. Please visit marchofdimes.com and join us in working together for stronger, healthier babies.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. Perhaps to the surprise of some investors, Vietnam ranks at or near the top of several lists of the most promising frontier markets. In this segment, we'll look into some of the reasons for that. I have journalist and editor-at-large Mark Townsend on the line from Dubai. Mark's covered business, economics, and politics there for Thomson Reuters, Euromoney, Finance Asia, and The Institutional Investor. He was also an important contributor to our book, Investing in Frontier Markets, which is available through Amazon and major bookstores. Welcome back to the program, Mark.
Good to be with you, Gavin.
Thanks. So Vietnam has, as noted, been at the top of some the lists of the most promising frontier markets. What's driving that, and what's the outlook for Vietnam in 2014?
Well, Gavin, there's a new World Bank report projecting GDP growth in Vietnam to rise fairly modestly to 5.5% by 2015. And it's citing macroeconomic stability largely restored, and the report is entitled Taking Stock. It's actually launched today. And it also says the medium-term macroeconomic outlook remains favorable on balance. And I quote from the report, it says, Vietnam has done well in ensuring macroeconomic stability over the past year, which has been underpinned by moderating inflation and strengthening external accounts. And that's Victoria Kowacka, the World Bank country director for Vietnam. But she does qualify that, and she says that focus should now be made on the slow-moving structural reforms to reposition Vietnam on a higher growth trajectory.
Yes, as always, structural reforms seem to be the ones that take time, because you do the easy stuff and then you have to do the more difficult stuff. What sort of structural reforms is the World Bank advocating?
Well, Taking Stock is a biannual assessment of the economy in Vietnam, and it cites several critical risks to macroeconomic stability. First of all, low foreign exchange reserves, which obviously is going to have an exposure when the dreaded tapering kicks in, and fragile private sector demand, possibility of departure from fiscal and monetary discipline, and I think this is the elephant in the lounge: slow progress on structural reforms and a loss of confidence in what is still a fragile banking sector. Gavin,
so the report talks about the non-performing loan problem for Vietnamese banks. How big exactly is that, and what measures are the government taking to deal with it?
Well, the big deal right now in Vietnam is the lingering state-owned enterprising restructuring, which has been much slower than expected. These are obviously state-controlled businesses which have run up huge debts, and more work is needed to ensure that the targets chosen for state-owned enterprise reforms are feasible, proper accounts taken of the complexity of the issues, and specifically individuals, state-owned enterprises, oversight and coordination. So there's non-performing loans, and the uncertainty about when these measures will be enacted put a big question mark over the banking sector, and it's a major concern, the World Bank says. And due attention is needed on the issues of bankruptcy, insolvency, and creditor rights. So that's a big issue in the Vietnam economy right now, Gavin.
But on the other side, Vietnam's become one of the major export success stories in the emerging markets in Asia over the last decade or so. What kind of outlook does it have for improving its exports, which will obviously give it foreign exchange and the opportunity to be able to fund some of these structural reforms?
Definitely. I mean, I think, you know, the issue that the World Bank cites about the low foreign exchange reserves, you know, give it a major exposure. And, you know, we've only got to sort of rewind back to the, you know, the Asian financial crisis some years ago to see what low foreign exchange reserves can do to a country's economy. So I think, you know, the fact that, you know, Vietnam is still really, in terms of trade facilitation and competitiveness and growth, the report says that, you know, exports are strong, but they are, you know, in a difficult external environment, but they are really intrinsically low-value product, and which they're exporting, and the report suggests an enhanced emphasis to add value. And, you know, that certainly is an ongoing dilemma, which, you know, the government will have to deal with in terms of transport infrastructure, logistics, you know, and really upping the economy to higher value products, Gavin.
So to finish up here, Mark, one of the issues that is flagged as a problem in Vietnam is the problem of poverty. An improving export sector, improved value add would obviously help address that. Are there any particular groups within the country that are especially suffering because of the problems of poverty or the unequal nature of the growth that's happening?
Well, the World Bank does say that most Vietnamese, you know, the quality of life has improved substantially over 2010 to 2012, even while growth was more modest than previously. That's generated a drop in the poverty rate and a likely decrease in equality. But, you know, ethnic minority welfare has improved greatly over time. But poverty still remains concentrated in these groups. And so, you know, it's an issue for the government to try and address these and try and, you know, obviously deal with the inequalities that continue. And obviously, corruption still looms very large over the country and is, you know, is very endemic.
Okay, Mark. So those are some of the sort of warning signs or things to be aware of. But to finish up here, you would still suggest that Vietnam looks a pretty attractive destination as far as foreign investors are concerned. The economy is making progress.
I think so. And I think the new year, Gavin, is going to see some further reforms in the real estate sector, maybe to open that a little bit more to foreign direct investment. They've got a slight, you know, issue there with the sort of the quality and also, you know, the size of the real estate book. So I think those reforms look good. There's certainly been substantial progress. And, you know, we shouldn't write off Vietnam. But, you know, for all the reasons that we've cited today, it does have exposures.
Okay. Well, thanks very much indeed, Mark. Really appreciate your insight on that. And thank you both for the contribution today and over the last few programs and to our book as well.
Good to talk with you as ever, Gavin. Thanks.
Our next guest has a brief look at the health of the Turkish economy, how it's dealt with some of the shocks that have happened lately, and also the potential shocks from things such as the beginning of tapering by the US Federal Reserve starting next year. Obviously, the huge inflow of refugees due to the Syrian crisis has been one issue they've had to deal with. But Turkey's actually dealt with it surprisingly well, all things considered. So to look at what's happening and the outlook, especially as Moody's Investor Services has recently published an outlook for Turkey in 2014, it's that time of year, people tend to be publishing outlooks for the year ahead. We welcome back Thomson Reuters financial journalist Dasha Afanasieva on the line from Istanbul.
Hello, thanks for having me back.
Please go ahead.
Moody's has had this report looking ahead to next year, and you know, still it lifted Turkey one notch to Ba3 with a stable outlook in May, and this time it just updated the market on what's likely to happen next year, and it actually looked like reasonably good news, in the sense that they said that when the long-feared tapering does happen, Turkey is actually quite well insulated, it said, in that, structural, that it may experience limited and short-lived impact from potential QE tapering, but has existing buffers that make this less painful.
So that's obviously good news as far as Turkish citizens and indeed investors in Turkey are concerned. Some of those buffers that have been built up would include?
Well, particularly it's since the 2009 crisis. The economy compared to Eurozone economies is actually doing reasonably well with a growth rate around 4%. It has a strong banking sector because Turkey's already gone through a banking crisis and has become very prudent off the back of that. Strong public finances as well people from the Turkish economy. But the downsides are a greater reliance on foreign market funding since 2009, which means that it has increased the Turkish banking system's vulnerability to sort of wholesale market conditions. But the exposure, Moody's thinks that the exposure is still moderate. Something that people do bring up a lot is the current account deficit that is financed by these, by this reliance on foreign capital.
So,
and great efforts are being made in terms of curbing consumer borrowing and that sort of thing to reduce sort of imports and reduce the current account deficit.
So, in other words, as you say, there is some reliance on foreign inflows to fund the current account deficit, but the Turkish financial system and particularly the banking system is in pretty good health, pretty robust shape because they have already been through their own banking crisis. Are there any particular effects on other sectors of the Turkish economy, other corporates that might arise from this sort of potential tightening of inflows if tapering does happen?
Well, and also I must say that that's kind of what Moody's has said in its update, not me. I'm not allowed to have opinions. But in terms of sectors, I think the what sort of area has been, you know, consumer spending, so companies that rely on that because the government's been reduced borrowing because loan growth has been so high and has seen a sort of consumption-led economic growth and increase in current account. So yes, that sort of thing. So think of examples. White goods, that's, you know, if you're hailing people's ability to borrow and then
okay. Dasha, so to summarize here, then the outlook generally as far as Turkish equities are concerned, despite the possibility of some interruption or some lessening of foreign inflows because of tapering, should not affect Turkish equities too much.
Oh, I don't know.
Okay.
just to tell you what Moody's has said, but the sectors that are more affected than others are banks and discretionary white goods spending, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Great.
Well, thanks very much indeed, Dasha. I do appreciate your insights on the what's happening in Turkey, and speak to you again soon in the new year.
Thank you. Thanks. Bye.
Happy
Christmas. Bye.
And happy Christmas. Thanks to Thomson Reuters financial journalist Dasha Afanasieva on the line from Istanbul, Turkey, for that look at the Moody's report on Turkish banks and the effect of potential reduction in capital inflows due to tapering. When we get back after the break, we'll be looking at where the proverbial rubber hits the road when the advisor and client sit down to make some investing decisions, and particularly where relatively unfamiliar markets like emerging and frontier markets are concerned, how advisors can help deal with some of the potential volatility. Thanks very much, and please stay with us for that.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Do you like what you hear about investing in emerging and frontier markets on this program? Would you like to learn more to increase your investing effectiveness? EFMI Media also publishes a subscription-based newsletter called EFMI. We'd like to tell you more about it. Drop us an email at info@emergingfrontier.ca. We've designed EFMI as a newsletter to provide expert and up-to-date news and analysis of opportunities in the same markets that we discuss here on Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. EFMI has information and analysis that you won't find anywhere else, and you can start receiving it by emailing info@emergingfrontier.ca.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the final segment of Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. When you work through all of the information about emerging and frontier markets that you're getting from this program and from such sources as news bulletins and brokerage reports, the time comes to make some investment decisions. In both the Investing in Frontier Markets and our upcoming Frontier Markets for Dummies, which is due out in the spring, probably March, we stress the importance of dealing with a financial advisor to help you make these investment decisions. The investment world becomes complicated, in fact, more complicated probably every year that goes by. And new markets such as emerging and frontier markets add to some of that complication. We hope you find these markets are attractive as we do, but we also agree, you agree with us that you probably need some help. I have advisor coach and speaker Jim Reuter on the line from Burlington, Canada, to tell us how we can help make that relationship work. Jim was also a contributor to our book and helped us a lot in addressing the issue of how advisors can position emerging and frontier markets for their clients. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Gavin.
So while we were researching our first book, Investing in Frontier Markets, you remarked these investments actually increase the obligations of the advisor to the client. Could you explain that?
Well, it's interesting. We should be the final segment today, but really this is the first step, this idea of working with advisors. That's really the first step. Final segment, but first step. Look, for advisors there, Gavin, as you know, advice is their product and service is their business. What that means is that the quality of their advice really defines the quality of the advisor that you've got working for you. So, and that also means that that's the quality of your experience when you work with them. So in terms of increasing their obligations, this is a different marketplace, a novel marketplace in some respects, a little bit different. But when the stakes are higher, as they are with emerging markets and frontier markets, investing, due to the inherent risks, I think, and the volatility, the need for a tailored specialty advice really increases. You know, so that 5 to 10% of a portfolio, perhaps, that's invested in this sort of market, and as that as it increases in real dollars, the issue gets even more critical. When the stakes increase, so does the need for knowledge and skill. So, to me, expertise is important to the degree that excellence is required. And I think in this case, because you're, by definition, in an emerging and in a frontier marketplace, in a place where, you know, like you're going through the list of places where, you know, we're just talking about Turkey and talking about, you know, Vietnam. These are places where we don't have all the information, which means that we need people who know how to process it properly and do it well. And yep. Investors need a lot of excellence here to be satisfied with their results.
So, as you said, in a way, it increases the advisor's obligation to the client because given the unfamiliarity of these markets to many investors, the due diligence obligations of an advisor actually increase.
Oh, I don't think there's any question about this at all. You know, and this is true on all levels, but particularly here, which I would say to be at the top of the financial investing pyramid. But for anyone considering emerging markets or frontier markets, there is an extra degree of due diligence necessary to be certain that you have an advisor or find one who is able to provide the guidance necessary to walk you safely down the rough and rocky road to success in this area. I think to be able to, to keep this analogy going, to be able to pick a safe and profitable way around obstacles means your advisor really needs to know where he or she is going and what you can handle along the way. So it goes, it's really important stuff.
And how does an individual investor ascertain whether an advisor has this capability? After all, this is a little bit more complicated than North American interest rates or fixed income products or even North American equities. How would an advisor get to a comfort level? An investor get to the right comfort level with his advisor on a subject like this?
I think there's a real duality here of due diligence, if I can alliterate like that. But I think that's true. You know, you need both. An advisor needs to be doing due diligence on the market, this program helps them do, and in their own study, and working with their, understanding their client. But I think the same thing happens with the client. But clients need to do their due diligence. So an advisor's experience with emerging markets and frontier markets is critical. You see, I think if they've never been on that road themselves, it's hard to know what the potential detours might be for them, for their clients. So a good guide is a combination of knowing the requirements of the marketplace and the capabilities of the investor. And I think that's a specialty talent. Not everyone has that depth of knowledge and experience necessary to do it successfully. So an investor's due diligence, so the flip side of the due diligence coin, requires an understanding, the advisor's knowledge of and expertise in emerging and frontier market investing. You know, I think you're looking, as an investor, you're asking for success stories. You're looking for familiarity.
Yep.
Ask
yep.
about how they handle the clients in that marketplace. Ask for the guidelines they have in the market. I think people who are obviously very good at things like this have rules of thumb that they can apply, quick things that they know you can understand. I think we can hear and feel that knowledge and expertise. Look for a process that they're following.
Yes. Yeah.
I think process rather than intuition is what investors are really need here.
I know, absolutely. And I think you're quite correct, because it's unreasonable, to be fair, to expect the average advisor to have the level of knowledge that a client might need to feel comfortable with investing in these markets. So where does that leave the individual?
Well, you know, it puts them in actually a very good place. And I think a place a lot of investors are already at, certainly in the high net worth affluent marketplace. But I think it's one that if you haven't got here, this actually, if you have an interest in emerging and frontier markets, gives you a chance to do something the average maybe investor or the average investor in this market hasn't. So this may very well mean that you need someone other than your usual advisor to join your financial advisory team. Now, if you don't have a financial advisory team, well, this can be the start of it then. You want to keep your current advisor as the team leader and have her coordinate your investment needs with the others. So to start the process, ask your current investment advisor about their expertise in or experience with the emerging market or frontier market investing situation. And I think if you're getting hesitation, you probably need to be looking for a referral to someone who understands. I don't think you need to upset the apple cart completely here, but you're wanting to find somebody who can do the specialty work needed in this specialty market.
So to finish up here, Jim, in this way of thinking, you may end up having more than one advisor for your investments. That, as you say, doesn't mean that you should part company with your existing advisor, especially if they're doing a job that you're satisfied with. But if they don't have the level of expertise in what is admittedly a fairly esoteric area, then you should be comfortable with adding an additional person to the team in terms of the advice team.
I think that very much like if you have a medical practitioner you work with, you have a specialty need, the medical practitioners routinely refer you to specialists that can handle
right.
those areas that they're not good at. Nobody wants to overstep their expertise. So yeah, you will be adding that, and you will create a team, and that's just going to give you way better results anyway. So now you've got two heads better than, rather than just one referring or advising you. It means greater clarity of mission, because you're going to understand more about what's going on. You have a couple people talking to you. I think it means even greater security, because you have more perspective to consider. Kind of goes back to that old saw from way back, Gavin. You know, together, everyone achieves more. I think everyone gets better. I don't think this hurts advisors. I think it helps them, and I know it helps investors when they get that, especially if they can use their existing advisor as the team coordinator, the team leader, to help put it all together. And that's the value here. Again, last segment, but really first a top of mind kind of issue, because a good advisor can help you guide you down that road to success that you want in emerging and frontier markets.
Excellent, Jim. Thanks very much indeed, and appreciate your contributions as always.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Thanks to it, and Merry Christmas to you too. Our thanks to advisor, coach, and speaker Jim Ritter on the line from Burlington, Ontario, for that look at what happens when you take our advice and start investing in emerging and frontier markets using the help of a financial advisor. That wraps up today's edition. Please join me again next week. I'll be back with a global roster of contributors to sort through what's involved in emerging and frontier market investing. I'm Gavin Graham. Our producer is Al Emid. We are the co-authors of Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk and Role in an Investment Portfolio, now available in English-speaking markets around the world, including sites such as Amazon.com. And we're nearing completion of our second book in this investment category, Frontier Markets for Dummies, which is set for release next spring. We're also the publishers of EFMI newsletter, which we'll be launching soon. Overall, we hope to be your go-to source for all manner of information on emerging and frontier markets. For more information, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Again, that's info@emergingfrontier.ca. Thanks very much, and please join us again next week.
Thanks for listening today to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with host Gavin Graham. Be sure to join us again next Wednesday at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for another edition. Have a profitable week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.